This episode of the Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. On this episode of the show, we talk bird dogs, double guns, and Western upland hunting with Cody Simons. Thanks for tuning in to episode number 253. All right, welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast, and a very happy new year to you all. Happy to be with you in another calendar year. Always feels a little bit strange, 2024, and we'll soon be reflecting back on another upland season in the books. I know we're not quite there for everybody. Things are wrapping up here in my neck of the woods. Minnesota is officially closed as of January 1st. Got a little bonus week of ruffed grouse hunting in Wisconsin that will end this upcoming Sunday, and there might be one more hunt for me before all is said and done, but we shall see. Either way, it was a fun and enjoyable season as always, and a pretty darn good one in the grouse woods as we look back on it. Some strange weather that led to kind of an extended primetime window, some really good conditions leading up to the season, and now as we are flirting with an actual winter, my thoughts are turning towards our lack of snow at this point in the year, and kind of hoping that if the temperatures do dip down, as I suspect they will, we get some snow in a hurry, because we really don't have much more than an inch or so, if that, throughout a lot of the rough grouse country. So they'll need it pretty soon. Hopefully we get it. But today we are going to be talking a lot more Western upland hunting with just a sprinkle of rough grouse hunting, because our guest today did get out on his first few rough grouse hunts this year out west. We will talk with Cody Simons shortly. I will just take a minute to thank Patreon patrons of the Birdshot Podcast, those of you out there making voluntary contributions in support of the show to keep these conversations coming your way. They are eligible for bonus content, Patreon giveaways, and a little Birdshot Podcast can cooler and sticker gift pack. You can learn more and sign up for that at patreon.com/birdshot. And with it being January of 2024, shifting gears a little bit, thinking ahead to some of the trade shows and upland gatherings on the horizon, and figured I would mention a couple of events that Upland Gun Company will be at. We get asked quite a bit if we will be at particular shows as folks are looking to see the guns from RFM in person. So a couple of those coming up early in 2024, the first of which being the Southeastern Wildlife Exposition, or the SeaWee Show, that is in Charleston, South Carolina. I have never been there. Upland Gun Company has never been there, but we are very much looking forward to it. We'll be in the Quail Village along with Onyx and some other exhibitors. That should be a good time coming up in February. So if you're anywhere near the Charleston, South Carolina area, I have heard very good things about that particular show, and we are certainly looking forward to attending that. The second event would be Pheasant Fest in South Dakota this year. I was just chatting yesterday with Ben Bredigan of Onyx Hunt and Matt Davis of Final Rise. Of course, two partners on the Birdshot Podcast, but also companies we work very closely with at Upland Gun Company. We are all joining forces this year and putting together a mega booth of sorts at Pheasant Fest in South Dakota. Final Rise, Onyx Hunt, and Upland Gun Company. Very excited for that. I have yet to attend a Pheasant Fest in a South Dakota location, so personally I'm just pretty excited to do that. And of course, it is another new venue, new location for Upland Gun Company. So if any of you out there listening were hopeful to get a look at some RFM shotguns at a trade show this year, perhaps those two events are an option for you. Figured I would mention that here. If you have any questions, you can always reach out to us directly at uplandguncompany.com. All right, let's talk Western Wings with Cody Simons of Sitka Gear. Cody and I have been in touch over the past couple of years. Turns out he's been listening to the podcast for quite a while, which is cool. And we learned that some of the conversations on this show have fueled his interest in side-by-side shotguns, as they have mine. We'll talk a little bit about those today, along with first bird dogs and upland hunting in the West. There's a second half of this conversation, which you'll hear the following week, where we dive a little bit deeper into the gear side of things, as Cody has a background in that world, technical clothing and such. So stay tuned for that. But for now, let's welcome into the conversation and on to the Birdshot Podcast in 2024, Cody Simons. All right, buddy. Well, my guest today, Cody Simons on the Birdshot Podcast. Thanks for joining me, buddy. All the way from Montana, right?
Yep. Yep. The south side of Bozeman, Montana.
Are you? Did you grow up out west?
I grew up in farther west than this, in like the northwest corner of Oregon, kind of like an hour from the coast.
Okay.
Been in Montana since 2019.
How'd you make the trek there? Was it work related or upland related? What was the big draw?
Yeah, hunting and fishing in school.
My
first dog I bought outside of Great Falls up north, and when I came through, just really liked the state and was like, man, I was kind of getting out of the Marine Corps at the time, and like, man, I gotta find a way to get out here, and found Montana State here in Bozeman, and ended up going to school here in Bozeman.
Okay. Awesome. And so first dog, tell me about the first dog that you were headed to Montana to purchase.
Yeah. So, Parker is a wired haired pointing Griffon. He was the first one I got. I've got a couple now, but, I knew I wanted a hunting dog, and I was into duck hunting a bit at the time, when I was back in Oregon, where duck hunting was like really good. And, so I kind of wanted a versatile dog. I knew I wanted to mess around with upland a little bit. Met a guy that had a Griff and just kind of like really liked the dog. When I just met the dog at a Sportsman's Warehouse, met the guy and he had his dog. It was really, really cool animal. Like Griffs are kind of funny when you look at them, they kind of got like human eyes and stuff. I was like, man, I want one of these.
They do have some personality or like just, yeah, character in their face. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And just really enjoyed it and, found a guy up here in Montana and, just came out. I actually just gotten home from a deployment in the Marine Corps and I was like, man, I'm going to get one, and took the truck out and wandered up there and picked him up, and then it was just kind of just downhill or uphill from there, just the dog training stuff. Got some pigeons and raised a bunch of bob whites and stuff, and just began the training for the next couple of years. It was a lot of fun and the upland bird hunting and stuff, so that was the beginning of it all.
That's cool. So if we go back a little bit further, growing up in Oregon, you mentioned duck hunting. How did hunting enter the picture for you? Was that a family affair? Did you find your way into it just independently? How did that come about?
Yeah. I have like uncles and stuff that hunted, but I never hunted with them, never went on like family trips. I got into hunting through
awareness about it.
Yeah. Like, and it was a thing, you know, like the town I grew up in, like the logging community, and everyone hunts and everything, but I found my way to it through a buddy in like middle school, I guess it was, just in the summer, started shooting his bow, and I was kind of like left out, wasn't shooting a bow, so I ended up getting a bow through that, and he took me on a trip to Eastern Oregon and started deer hunting and stuff, and then deer and elk was the main thing that I did all through high school and stuff. Spent a lot of time hunting blacktails and Roosevelts there in Oregon.
Okay, so do you remember the, like, sort of the inflection point? Maybe it was the dogs. Like, what sort of piqued your curiosity about bird hunting?
Yes, I had gone on a couple of bird hunts, just pheasant hunts, with actually my mom had like traveled for work a little bit, and we ended up in a place in Washington that was just loaded with pheasants, and ended up on a pheasant hunt there with, I think, people that she had worked with. And they had a short hair and ran with that dog a little bit. And that was a ton of fun, but that was pretty early on. And then kind of like left the bird hunting thing behind when it was just deer and elk, really where I was like the main good hunting. But always like enjoyed, always like grew up with dogs and stuff, but just not hunting dogs. And like wanted my own dog and, was really getting kind of interested in bird hunting and stuff. And, another buddy ran, his dad had short hairs and stuff. It kind of got me interested in dogs, and he ended up kind of being like the mentor in dog training, but just grew up around dogs and just knew I wanted a dog. And then hunting was also like a pretty big part of my life, so made sense to get a hunting dog.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we got to talk sort of first dog stuff a little bit. That's a pretty common topic on this podcast, both for myself and many guests. But so how old is Parker now?
He is, I guess, 7. Yeah, 7 years old.
7. Okay. All right. Yep. So, no doubt, seven years old. You've been through some things, probably some ups and downs, some highs and lows. Yeah. As you look back on those 7 years of first dog stuff, like what do you kind of draw out of that? Both like sort of how you approach things, and then kind of what you learned from the dog over those years.
Yeah. I guess like the first thing that comes to mind is I probably tried to push like training too hard and should have just let him be a dog and a puppy and stuff initially. You know, I was trying to like always get to like the next checkbox in dog training or whatever. And probably just went too hard, too fast, and didn't let him like develop a lot of just kind of basic bird hunting and bird dog traits and stuff. Initially, I guess, probably would have just tried to spend more time in good bird hunting areas too, just with like more birds. Oregon's kind of tough for that, especially on the coast. Like we have quail and some grouse around and stuff, but didn't really have like ready access to wild birds. So we had to drive a couple hours to get into like the Chucker Hills or find some good quail spots or pheasants. So I would have put more effort into just getting him out on wild birds and less time with like the backyard training stuff, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I could see that. And that's probably good advice for most people, just kind of lean on that natural development. But it's, man, that's hard to do, I feel like, when you're, I don't know, depending on the kind of person you are. Like, I'd be curious if you picked up any books or specific training resources. You know, you get a hunting dog and you just kind of feel like, well, there's got to be like some important stuff I've got to be doing. You know, it's not just about just taking this dog out and letting him run, but in many ways it is if you're running them in the right places.
Yeah. Yeah. I read a couple, I don't remember what books they were. I remember reading them, on my phone actually, when I put like my deposit on Parker. I was actually still out of the country, in the Marine Corps, and I could get phones on like the Kindle app, or I could get books on like the Kindle app on my phone, and I read a couple of dog training books and like books about griffs and stuff like that. But I was fortunate to have my friend's dad, the one that has the short hairs and stuff, and he was pretty involved in like local dog training circles and stuff like that, and he kind of like guided me along with it. But I leaned on that a lot more so than like books or like online training resources or something. I would just kind of like bounce back to him and ask him for his kind of guidance on like what was up with Parker and what he needed to work on and what he was struggling with and stuff like that.
Yeah. That's a good resource to have, somebody that's even just been through it one time. You know, they can sort of help shed a light on a lot of questions that you probably have that you can't always get when, you know, you can't ask the author of the book, those clarifying questions, which sometimes makes that information kind of go in and out.
Yeah, no doubt.
It's like when you said you went kind of seriously on training, it just sort of reminded me. I know I read like, I mean, between like when a person puts down their deposit and then the time they pick up their first puppy, there's probably a lot of books that get read. I know I read a few, and I don't know that that's, you know, necessarily the right thing or the wrong thing. You know, I was trying to build a foundation of information, really, and I think it paid off in some ways. But I remember reading this one book. It was called How to Speed Train Your Bird Dog, I think, by Larry Mueller. It was recommended by somebody else. And like, I don't remember much from that book. And I don't think it was a bad book. But what I remember is, I think there was actually a lot of good information in there. But what I remember is he had this like elaborate like pulley or like zip line setup where he was like pulling things around and just like, just stuff that like to a beginner. And then he was doing these bacon drags where he's like dragging bacon through the grass, so like that kind of stuff. I just remember it put these ideas in my head like, well, I'm never going to be able to do this. Like I cannot accomplish this in my backyard with my dog. And none of that stuff was all that important, but it was that book's an older book, so it was written from a different time. It made me laugh thinking about that.
That's funny, man. Maybe that's why Parker's average. I didn't do enough bacon drags when he was young.
That could be. Yeah. Do you remember doing anything training wise that you look back on now and just be like, that was just silly?
I spent a lot of time doing like duck searches and stuff. Like when we were duck hunting, we'd save ducks, and I had a field behind my house. I was lucky that I had a little training area. But I would like drag ducks and he would, like looking back and I'm like, man, I probably messed that up. He would point, when he would find the duck, he would point it and I'd be like, no, you're supposed to fetch it and like tell him to fetch. And then I was like, later when I got really into upland, having problems with him just flushing birds. And I was like, probably because I just spent 3 months teaching this dog to not point at dead birds, like birds when he found them. I probably messed that one up, but now I know. Best way to learn it, I suppose. That
sounds like, sounds like first dog stuff to me.
Yep.
You don't really have the, I guess that's sort of it, especially with a first dog. You don't necessarily have a clear vision of the end result if you haven't, been around finished bird dogs or very seasoned bird dogs. You just hard to picture what that finished result is, and then you don't really know what you're working towards. I guess I would say that was kind of affected me in many ways.
Yeah, no doubt. And like knowing now, having seen other people's dogs, and then my other dog is definitely a little bit sharper of a bird dog. Definitely would help training the next one.
So you have two now?
Yeah, I have a setter as well, a female setter.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yep.
Where's the setter out of?
She is a Tocoa Mountain dog, so from Oregon, okay. Actually, interestingly enough. I bought her, I don't remember the name of the guy's kennel. It was a newer trainer in kind of a weird situation. Also, had just gotten out of the Marine Corps, became a dog trainer, or was like, aspiring to be a dog trainer, and thought that he was doing horseback trial stuff, and thought that she was like a little too short running. And I picked her up out of Colorado, a lot closer to me than Oregon. So I cruised down and picked her up. She was started. She was a year, just over a year, maybe a year and a half when I got her. And she's just been great. I haven't done as much training with her, more so just kind of like keeping her exposed to birds now here. And one of the benefits of living in Montana is I can drive about 10 minutes from my house, and there's a little piece of state land that has Huns on it. So I'm just keeping them kind of on birds throughout the training season and stuff. I don't do a whole lot of like heavy training with her. It's more just keeping her exposed to birds, but she's the rock star of the crew right now.
That's awesome. How old is she now? Like how long have you had her?
She is, I guess, like 3 now. Yeah. She'd be 3, 3 and a half.
Okay. So a season or two you've been running her now.
Yep. I think this is my second season with her. Yeah. And she's fun. She's a little small dog. She's 30 pounds and just rips.
Oh, wow.
She's fast. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I'm smiling because I got a small female setter. She's Rose is like 36 or 37 pounds. So that sounds even smaller, but same, very light on her feet and covers ground.
Yeah. Yeah. She's fun to hunt with. She just rips. Parker, just typical Griff, plays the kind of close range. And he's the retriever of the team. And
they can probably run together pretty well with that kind of range setup.
Yeah, I run them. I actually kind of am thinking that I need to stop doing this so much, but I run them mostly together all the time.
Okay.
Just with like my setups of hunting, unless I go on a longer trip where I'm out for several days, I'll split them up and let them run independently. But I run them together most of the time. So she's kind of out on like the 100 to 300 yard range most of the time, and Parker's on the like from your feet to like 70 yards maybe. he's a close working guy, but they work out together really well, and Parker retrieves way stronger than Lucy the setter does, so they work together well.
A little setter named Lucy, I like it. What's got you thinking that you want to kind of break them up a bit?
I think Parker has lost all of his confidence. When I watch him, I think he's not looking for birds much anymore. He's looking for Lucy to back a point. He backs really consistently. He kind of just naturally started doing it. And if he's near me and he hears the GPS go off, he starts searching for her. And maybe he's thinking about the birds, but I just, when I watch him run and I watch the way he's like looking around, I feel like he's looking for her to be on point somewhere and not really like searching for birds.
Yeah. Yeah. I would actually say that my older setter Hartley does that a little bit. Not, I mean, I rarely hunt him and Rose together, and maybe that's one reason why, but usually it's the reason that that is really making my decision is I'm just looking to spread out my dog power and hunt two different yeah. spots and take one dog in each spot. So that's kind of more why I do it. But I've often wondered about this. Hartley, he was my first dog, and I hunted with my friends when he was younger, but I don't know if I did a lot of like the right amount of exposure to running with other dogs, or maybe he just does that. But I've noticed that too. Like if I run him with another dog in certain situations, you know, he's kind of paying attention to what that other dog is doing and where are they going, and oh, is there going to be a point over here? Which I don't know. I find it a little unusual because I didn't hunt him with other dogs a whole lot, but maybe that's just the way he is. But yeah, I know what you're saying there. They need to have their own independent confidence, and if you can start to notice that if they're paying attention to the other dog or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And when it was just Parker, when I just had Parker and hunt Montana and stuff, he found and pointed, you know, a couple coveys a day or something, depending on the spot and the year and whatnot.
But yeah, you've seen it now, change now.
Oh yeah, and I mean it's tough too because she runs a lot bigger and she's a lot faster and she's out ahead of him, so she's maybe just finding birds first. But I mean, Parker's only pointed his own without backing Lucy. He's only found his own coveys of like Huns, or he finds sharp tails. He'll pick up a sharp tail that she misses every once in a while.
Yeah,
but he only has found like a handful of coveys on his own this year without her being right there in front of him pointing. So I need to just separate him because he used to be a lot more proficient. I think he's just gotten lazy and is just looking for her. And we do plenty fine with just Lucy pointing him and him backing. So he's like, oh,
yeah, right.
Why would I search for my own?
He's
I
like, think this is fun.
That's what he's thinking. Yeah, this is cool. I'll just go pick him up when we're done. Yeah.
Yeah. That would be interesting. That's one thing that me not running two dogs a whole lot, I don't have a lot of instances where I see, you know, maybe a dog buzz through an area and then another dog go in there and point a bird. It's like, oh, you missed that one. You know, you can kind of shine a light on some of those things.
Yeah.
Not that it was like a mistake or anything, but just there's a lot of ground out there, and you know, it's you put one dog down and you kind of walk a route through the cover and you're like, yeah, we pretty much covered it. But I think more often than not, there's probably some hidden nooks and crannies that, you know, the dog's not covering every inch of it.
Yeah, for sure. Lucy, I'm not sure what it is about sharp-tailed. I'm curious if other people have seen this with their dogs. Like Lucy does amazing on Huns and pheasants, and but like sharp-tails, she sometimes will just run past, like right past a sharp-tail, and like no birdiness or anything. She'll just breeze right past it, and then Parker will find it, or I'll flush it or something. And I'm like, how the heck did we miss that one? I swear she ran right past it. Curious if other people see that, because I don't hear other people saying that, but I've always noticed that.
Do you notice like any, is it, like, have you seen it more recently now that it's December versus September, or is it just kind of across the board?
No, it's just across the board. Yeah, it's a little weird. Just on Friday, actually, I took one of my coworkers out and we hunted, and she did great. I think we'd found three coveys of Huns, locked up on all of them, solid points. Shot a couple of birds, and then she pointed but was really confused. I could see her. She was across like a little coulee, and I could see her confused, and she wasn't serious about it. Like if she knows there's birds, she's like dead still, and she was kind of like twitching her tail around and kind of like turned her head as like, oh, she doesn't have birds. So I like called her off of it, and she came back over to us, and then Parker went through and actually flushed the birds, and I was like, there was six sharp tails sitting, and she pointed right next to him. Good wind, and just was like really unsure about it and just left them. She didn't search them out when I called her off the point or anything, and just completely missed them and walked away from them. And then Parker went through and ended up finding it. He didn't point them, but ended up flushing them up. So yeah, it's weird. She just misses them sometimes.
Yeah. Interesting. Nothing. I wouldn't know, but I'd be curious if any other listeners have experienced that. So you can get sharp tails pointed in December, if I'm understanding that correctly.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely can. Yeah. It's happened.
And you can get somewhat close to them.
Yeah. They do get, man, they get jumpy sometimes. But yes, something in the right spot. I mean, if they can, I think a lot of it is just like geography of how, where they happen to be sitting and where you're hunting and if they can see you, man, they're there. But yeah. Yeah, we do more so in November. We don't have a ton of them like near where I am. We get some occasionally, but, when I head like north or northeast or east, we find a ton of them when we're looking for hounds and stuff. And yeah, they can be pointed and can be shot in December, but it does get tough. They get a little jumpy and the shots get a little farther.
Yeah. From everything I've heard, I mean, they definitely, that bird changes quite a bit from the bird that I know that I've been hunting in September, which makes sense because the September stuff, I mean, it's really enjoyable. We've talked about it a bunch on the show. It is somewhat predictable. Like they're just those young birds and, it ends up setting up really well for pointing dogs. But I guess I've been out on the prairie in November. I went to South Dakota one time and saw some of the big flocks, the biggest flock of sharptail I've ever seen coming down and landing in a sunflower field. It was like looked up and guy I was with was like, those are sharptails. I'm like, are you kidding me? I mean, the sky was full of them. It's like, wow. Yeah. Those really? Are sharptails. I've never seen a group that big, but yeah, they tend to group up and get warier from everything I've heard. I was curious so it sounds like you're chasing huns quite a bit. What other opportunity have you guys been having the same kind of unusually warmer snow free ish late season as we have? What's it been like over there?
Yeah, it's been an odd year. We've had like middle of October conditions since the middle of October, so it's been odd in that sense. Yeah, it's nice for bird hunting. Kind of curious what next year is going to bring, if we're going to have kind of drought conditions worse than normal with no snowpack or something like that. But we have gotten in a lot of bird hunting in spots where we normally wouldn't, because the snow would usually be stacked up pretty deep. Like I said, been great for bird hunting, but it's been an odd year. November, when I'm out like mule deer hunting, is usually a really cold game, and it was like 50 degrees in the middle of the days in the middle of November when I was hunting mule deer and stuff. So been a different year, no doubt.
Yep. Yeah. Very, very similar here, which again, we've talked about a bit, but just kind of unusual. And yeah, that's maybe the biggest thing is I mean, I certainly appreciate the, what feels like a lot of bonus walks in areas that I normally wouldn't even be thinking about going into this time of year. So I've got some extra exploration and scouting, which will pay dividends in future years. That's been fun. I mean, it's like the last 24 hours felt like actually winter. We have a dusting of snow and it was below 20 degrees yesterday, but now it's 21.2 here now, and it's going to get up over 30 today. And then it honestly looks like we've got 30s through basically the new year, which kind of takes us through our rough grouse season. I mean, if we get through this whole season with almost no snow and 30 degree temps, I don't know that I ever remember a year like that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah, this is definitely the lightest winter we've had since I've lived in Montana. There's no doubt. It's been nice because I've been mountain grouse hunting a lot more, hunting duskies and stuff.
Yeah.
Normally normally people are skiing and ski touring around on the trails and stuff outside of town here. And I can walk up on dry ground and find birds.
Yeah. I was going to ask, hopefully that coworker wasn't the spark for you to put up the Instagram story about the golden rule of hunting.
No, it wasn't. No, this was a buddy of mine.
Okay, good.
No, he's a pretty experienced hunter, just new to the upland world. So it was fun. We got to go out and get first hunt for a sharptail, shot a bunch of quail.
That's
stuff.
Cool.
He's from Texas. Yeah, I got to go and he got to see some good, we walked out and got good dog work and everything. It was kind of later in the day and I usually hunt in the mornings more so, but I wasn't sure how it's going to go, but turned out to be a good day. Moved a handful of covey, I guess 3 or 4 coveys of huns, and then that one good group of sharptails. So got to shoot huns and sharptails for the first time. So it was a good trip, and it was like just a couple hours after work on Friday. So it worked out.
Awesome. It's been a pretty good season for huns out there. I experienced it a little bit back in September, but from the sounds of it, the hun numbers were pretty good this year.
Yeah, it's been an awesome year. A lot of the spots that I hunt locally, that normally I'd find a covey or two or maybe three, I've found like earlier in the season, we'd find like six or eight or something on a 3 or 4 mile walk. So it's been a really good year. And the time I've spent like out northeast or northeast of where I live anyhow, not like necessarily northeast Montana, have just been great. Like every walk I've gone on, I went on a longer trip earlier this year, and every walk we went on, we found a couple coveys of Huns and a bunch of sharptails, and found, I don't spend a ton of time on pheasants, so I don't have like a real good read on how many there normally are, but found a bunch of birds in some new spots. But man, it's been an awesome year of bird hunting, no doubt.
How much does the Hun hunting change throughout the season? Like we talk about the sharptails kind of being, you know, maybe a little bit easier to approach in September, but they get warier and they group up, that kind of thing. Does anything similar to that happen with Huns, or they kind of move into different areas? Obviously the cover and crops change a little bit, but how does that progress throughout the season?
I definitely don't see like that big of a difference like you'd see with other birds, but a lot of what I noticed and just like what determines where I hunt is dependent on like the weather and then geography of where they'll be within the weather. So if it's like real cold and windy, it's kind of obvious where they'll be. They'll be, you know, out of the wind, somewhere that's a little bit maybe heavier cover and just has geography blocking the wind. They definitely do get jumpier because I like one of the spots I keep mentioning, if it has like a lot of like little bigger valleys that I wouldn't necessarily call like a coulee, but they're maybe like 200 yards across, and they'll get into the spots. Like if it's snowy and the sun's kind of burnt some of the snow off and there's like open grass, they'll see you, they'll be out feeding in those or something, and they'll see you from a couple hundred yards away and fly off. But where maybe you wouldn't get that in earlier season. I also usually don't hunt in like September. So it's kind of hard to say like from early season to late season, like what the
are you
full
just doing
changes,
other
but,
stuff, or is it just too hot, heat, that kind of thing? Or
yeah, it's archery, elk hunting mostly.
Okay.
Yep, just doing other big game hunts and stuff earlier in the year, and it kind of works out too because I let the weather kind of cool down and stuff. And Parker overheats if it's like 40 degrees, so he's a cold weather animal. But spend September usually archery hunting or something.
That makes sense.
I'll get out in some mornings and do like some mountain grouse hunts and stuff like that. But yeah, as far as Huns go, like I don't see like a huge shift in where they are. They like still generally seem to be in the same place. They might just be like tucked in a little bit in like a little bit different geography and a little different cover to stay out of the wind and to stay warm.
Yeah. So, all right, transitioning from Huns, first rough grouse not that long ago. What was it, a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, two weekends ago, I guess.
Talk me through it, man. You went out after them. You must have seen them before, but you decided this was the year.
Yeah, we'd been after them, and I hear them a lot when I'm bear hunting in the spring or just hiking in the spring. I hear them drumming and whatnot.
Okay,
and,
that's cool.
Yeah, so kind of had an idea of where some of them might be, but we don't have like, I guess the mountain range near me doesn't really have like great cover for it, but I knew some would be around and spent a lot of time looking for duskies and stuff, and would kind of walk through the what I thought was going to be rough grouse covers, and kind of just got me more interested in it. Started hunting a spot that like the roads kind of closed down December 1st here, so I went into a spot that the roads were still open to lead me into the mountains. It was a weird day, and I feel like I would have shot birds that day, but I happened to choose like the day that everyone was getting their Christmas trees, and out in Montana, I know how it works where you are, but in Montana, you buy a tag essentially from the Forest Service for like a couple bucks, and you just go out into the mountains and cut down a Christmas tree. Well, like I didn't know people took it that serious, and they were going to be like more than a couple hundred yards from the trailhead. And there were people everywhere, all in the mountains getting Christmas trees. So I didn't want to shoot. We ended up moving, I think, 5 birds that day, one morning. And I was uncomfortable about there being so many people, and also just didn't get shots.
Jeez.
The nature of how they fly. So that day, that was my first real day of like finding rough grouse. Moved, well, I guess what we would call a bunch of birds. I don't know if that's a bunch of birds or like Michigan or whatnot, but found a bunch of birds that day, didn't shoot at any. And I was like, I'm going to come back one morning before work when there's nobody out here. Went back, had a couple of really good points on birds. And one of them, I saw it on the ground. I was like, I am surely going to get this bird. I have a feeling it's going to fly right downhill. It's open. It flies straight away. So like on like the contour of the mountain, and like happened to get behind the one tree that was like taller than I was, and I couldn't see it. I was like, dang, I thought that was my chance. I was like, I'm going to give these ones a break. I'm going to go somewhere new. Headed out to another, this was the next weekend, headed out to another range that I spend a lot of time like mule deer and elk hunting in. And found like a bigger area that I thought might have birds. Like previously I was kind of hunting just like a little small spot, and it was like a mile or so. And then you're kind of out of cover and had to go back. So found a bigger area where I could kind of wander a little bit more and there wouldn't be anybody around. Got out. I'll actually tell you about the second one, because the first one was kind of lame. I feel kind of dumb about shooting the first one. But the second one, I'd gone way up, started low, hunted for rough grouse, went way up, climbed, I think like 1400 feet. I was looking for duskies, and I was just going to go until I found them and then come back down. Well, I went dang near to the top of the mountain. I didn't find them. So I came back down. Lucy went on point. I got a notification that she was on point. It was in just like little furs, like 8 to 10 foot tall fur, so you can't see anything.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of like working my way through, looking for her, and it says I'm like looking at my GPS and it says she's like 30 feet away, and I'm like, I don't see her. I put the GPS back in my pocket and I'm like poking around, and I get another notification that she's on point. Now it says 40 yards. And I'm like, oh, what the heck? She must be like chasing something. That's odd for her. Usually she wouldn't break and go after something. But I work my way to her again, and I find her, and I see her in like another little patch of like Christmas tree, you know, dug furs, and she's staring straight up in the air. And I was like, what the heck? And yeah. I'm looking, and there's a bird like maybe 8 or 9 feet up in a tree, and she's just staring at the bird. And this will probably sound pretty weird, pretty foreign for like what I understand is normal rough grouse behavior. But I couldn't get the bird to fly out of the tree, and it was only like a couple feet above my head. There's not much openings, but I'm like, I could give it a try. So I like grabbed onto a little branch of the Christmas tree it was sitting in, and I like tugged on it to like wiggle the tree, and it wouldn't fly. And I was like, okay, I thought that was going to definitely work. And it didn't fly. And it's just sitting there. I was like, well, I'm not going to like shoot the thing at like, you know, a couple feet out of the tree. Like that's terrible. I'm not going to back up and shoot it out of the tree.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I can pretty much reach it with my barrel. So I've got my 30 inch barrel, 28 gauge. And I was like, well, I can just poke it. And I reach out with my gun and bumped the bird with the end of my gun, and it flew off and it flushed, luckily the direction I wanted it to, and flushed out a little ways and shot it. And that was the one that I sent you the picture of that had the really nice like black collar and all that, really pretty bird.
Yeah.
But yeah, like super weird situation. I was telling Levi Day about it, and he's like, what in the world? Like, I've never heard anything like that. I'm like, that's how a rough grouse acts. It was a little odd. I didn't expect that that would be the situation of killing the first one, or I guess the second one, but, it was cool. It was fun. I put a fair amount of time into chasing them, and was stoked that I actually found one, cause I don't think there's a ton of them around in Montana. I hear them here and there, but not like a mess of them by any means. So it was cool to get one.
Well, that right there is maybe the number one reason why you've got to have 30-inch barrels on a grouse gun, Cody, right?
Yeah, exactly, for poking rough grouse out of trees in Montana.
Yeah. Well, if you believe everything you hear, the further east you go, the rough grouse is a warier and warier bird, and the further west you go, north, I guess, into Canada, they become a little bit less like that. I mean, I see plenty of birds hop up into trees in Minnesota, and from time to time that, you know, they will not flush. I mean, they'll definitely sit up in a tree, and there's, depending on sort of how you're feeling that day, there's an art to going about how to getting the bird to flush out of a tree and still trying to get an opportunity on it if you care to take those shots. More and more, I don't really like shooting at them when they're coming out of trees, just because, I don't know, it's a difficult shot, and I don't like winging birds or anything like that. So sometimes I don't even shoot them anymore. But that's usually if you bump the tree in my experience, that's going to get the bird to go. So to actually have to, now I have had it happen where, you know, you're throwing sticks and that kind of stuff, but you never know. They're just, they're goofy like that sometimes, and they don't, clearly that one didn't want to take off in that area. But
yeah, the first one I shot that morning flushed from a snowball off of a tree branch. That's how I got that one to fly. Lucy again threw one in a tree, and I was throwing snowballs at it to try and get it out of the tree.
Yeah,
I finally did. Yeah. But yeah, not the most sporting thing I've ever done, I guess.
Yeah,
I was just really excited. You know, I was like, "There's a rough grouse," and it's just sitting there. I was like, "I'm not going to shoot it off the limb. I have to get it to flush." And I was probably 20 snowballs in before I finally got close enough to get it to fly off. But
I mean, that's like, you know, that just like affirms the stuff, you know, like how underwhelming you've got this treasure troves of books and literature, and the rough grouse is built up into this magnificent bird, which it is, don't get me wrong, but then Cody's first bird, he's got to throw a snowball at it to get it out of the tree.
Exactly. And the second one I had to bump with my gun barrel.
It was cool. I was surprised. Not off to a great start in your book.
No, I was still excited about it. I thought they were, I was envisioning a lot larger bird, like something similar to like a blue grouse, like a dusky or something. And duskies are really big. And I don't know. I was just thinking like, oh, those are the grouse I hunt. These grouse will be big too. I was surprised at the size of them. I thought they were bigger bird. But
I swear, I just talked to somebody recently that was telling me, I can't remember who it was or where it was, but they were telling me that they were hunting rough grouse, I think, and they were like surprised at how big the bird was. And for some reason, I thought it was a Western hunter, but maybe I dreamt that up. I have no idea, but certainly my understanding, they're definitely smaller than a blue grouse, dusky grouse.
Yeah,
I've never had my hands on one of those, but
yeah, a big blue is a pretty hefty bird. Like they look smaller because they don't have the long tail of a pheasant or whatever, but like I would say, like weight of like meat wise, they're very similar to like a big rooster, blue grouse.
I really want to do a blue grouse hunt, and I've talked to folks about kind of doing that in September when it's, you know, it's a little cooler up where the blues are. I don't know when would be likely for me to do it, but I really would like to. I'd like to see and get a chance to bag one of those birds.
They're a lot of fun, man, and you will most likely not see anybody else doing it. I run into like two other people in the couple years that I've been around Montana and kind of poked around a little bit. Took it more serious this year, and I saw two guys, which was like kind of abnormal. One of them's like a local legend mountain grouse hunter, and the other guy was like a dude from New York just looking for grouse. He'd moved to Montana but wanted a grouse hunt still. But they're a lot of fun.
So how did you get you're hunting grouse now. How did you get this into side-by-sides? You get the bug for side-by-side shotguns.
Yeah. I was thinking about that, and I was trying to track it back. I've always really liked over-unders. I like just double-barrel guns I thought were really cool. And I remember being younger thinking that side-by-sides were kind of goofy and just like old school guns, and liked a little bit more like modern over-unders and stuff. But I guess when I started like searching for my first side-by-side was one of the earlier Project Upland podcasts that you must have done with like Greg Elliott or something on vintage American guns. And I remember him mentioning there was like a portion of it where it was like getting into them for cheap or something, or like the affordable ones. And it was like Parker Trojans or Sterlingworths or something. And I was like, I'm going to start looking for these. And like Parkers were kind of hard to obtain. Obviously I was interested on how Parker got his name. But I found a Sterlingworth. Yeah. A 16 gauge Sterlingworth. It was like a little bit goofy of a gun. It had like a big beaver tail forend, but it was like in my price range. And I just knew I like wanted one. I thought it was cool looking, and I got it. But yeah, I think initially it was that one of those podcasts where someone was mentioning like
that's
budget
funny.
American side by sides. And I was like, you know, 20 something years old, early 20s, didn't have like the most spare money to go around, and found a Sterlingworth for like a couple hundred bucks on Guns International and bought that one. And then just kind of
stayed
with it.
And it was a 16 gauge too, though.
Yeah, it was. It was a good deal. Yeah. Looking back on it, it was a good deal. I think people maybe avoided it because like the beaver tail looked maybe kind of goofy and like it kind of more so resembled like one of the later like B models. Yeah, B model. Yeah, when it became Savage. So I think maybe people just overlooked it thinking it was like a B model, but yeah, it's a Sterlingworth 16 gauge, 28 inch barrels, like moderately short. I think it was like 13 and three quarters or something, but I put a little bit of a pad on it. And it fits me pretty decent now. Yeah, that was the beginning of it all, of the side by side stuff. And now it's primarily what I shoot. I still shoot my over under a little bit here and there, mostly if I have to shoot non-toxic somewhere. On like a like we have waterfowl production areas where you have to shoot non-tox shot, and there's mostly pheasants and sharp tails and stuff around on those areas, so I'll carry my 12 gauge, my over under for that, but yeah, mostly just the side by sides now.
Yeah, and you're starting, you've got a little collection started. I know, like, I don't know when we started chatting, it was a while ago, certainly before we built your RFM. But yeah, I remember you as the guy that stumbled into a Fox shotgun that I would love to own. Tell me about that one, if you care to tell that story.
Yeah, no doubt. People seem to be interested in it, and people don't believe it.
By the way, I did just see a picture of that beautiful gun and a dusky grouse on your Instagram recently.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I was drooling over that. So very nice photo.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was just in downtown Bozeman. We have, there's a store called Schnee's that's, they make boots, and they also have like a consignment area of the store.
Interesting.
That they have guns. And they like, interestingly enough, maintain like a pretty cool inventory of old guns. Usually like maybe 10 old side-by-sides or something, but they're side-by-sides to look at. So we were downtown. It was actually, I think maybe New Year's or the day before New Year's. And we had just gotten back from a Christmas trip, and my girlfriend was like returning something at a store downtown, and we just walked by Schnee's. I was like, let's just pop in here and take a look. Like, I like to comb through the guns and check stuff out. And I was looking at it, and the tag said like Fox Sterlingworth, and I was like looking at it, like, well, this clearly isn't a Sterlingworth. Like, I don't know a lot, but
it's got
engraving. This isn't a Sterlingworth. It has engraving on all over the receiver and on the barrels. And I was like, well, it's definitely not a Sterlingworth if it has engraving on the barrels. And I was kind of looking at it, and I was taking pictures of it, and I was like Googling the serial number, and I just like finally, it's like a bunch of young kids, and I was like, do you mind if I take this gun apart? And they were kind of like, I guess. And took it apart, and it has the, you know, B's stamped on the action. And I was like, man, I think this is a B grade. And I'm looking at it, and I like took some photos, and like couldn't quite figure it out. And it was like loose, the action was loose and stuff, but like overall in pretty good shape. And just like got to looking at it online a little bit, and I was like, I am like 95% sure that this is a B grade, and they have it marked as a Sterlingworth. And I asked the kid, I was like, how do you guys like assess the value of these guns? And like, we have a guy like that works here, and he knows most stuff, or he can like research his way to most things. I was like, okay, interesting. Like, is there any like bartering with these prices? And he's like, yeah, we could call the owner if you really wanted to. And I'm like looking at the price. I was like, no, it's fine. Like, I would like to buy this thing. And he's like, okay, cool. Ended up being a weird situation.
Which should have been a red flag for him, but
yeah,
not sure, a, like, not a red flag, but it should have been antenna up.
Yeah. But I'm looking at it, and yeah, I end up buying the gun, and it was marked for $750.
Gosh.
So I'm like, even if it is a Sterlingworth, like, it's really not that bad of a price for a 16 gauge Sterlingworth. But it's clearly not. And it's stamped with B's, and the serial numbers line up to be like a 1913 B grade Fox. Ended up buying it, and the kid like hands me the receipt and hands me the gun. I was like, is everything finished here? Like, do I legally, like, is this mine now? And he's like, yeah. And I was like, can I tell you something about this gun? And he's like, yeah, is it worth a lot more than it is? And I was like, yeah, man, like, this is a really pretty, like, not rare, but like,
gosh.
I was like, it's not a very common gun. And this is like another 20-year-old guy that I'm talking to. And he's like, you know, we went back and forth about this, and like, I was just Googling pictures of Sterlingworths, and I was telling the guy that I didn't think it was a Sterlingworth, but he was like set on the fact that it was a Sterlingworth. I was like, yeah, it's a B grade, man.
Gosh.
Like, this gun's worth a lot more than $750. Like, even in the current state it is, it needs to be rejoined and stuff. We have a local gunsmith in downtown Bozeman, actually just a few doors down, and had it, rejoin and put back on face and stuff, and then carrying it around since. So I'm like just over $1,000
for you. You pop in, grab a Fox B grade, bring it down to, you brought it to, was it Charlie of Rod and Hill, right?
Yep.
Okay. Or no, Hill and Rod. What's his shop called?
Hill Rod and Gun. Yep. That's him.
Hill Rod and Gun. Yeah. Yep. Okay. I don't know him, but I've looked at his, he maintains a website and has a really nice selection of sort of side by English, typically English guns, although he has other stuff for that are kind of like that would appeal to most bird hunters. So lots of shotgun candy on his website.
Yeah, no doubt. And he's always got a really interesting inventory of guns. Yeah, mostly English stuff, but has some American guns from time to time, and has been very fair for random gunsmithing work that I brought him lately. But so the B grade is all
incredible.
Operational, and it's a little 2.5-inch chamber, and I reload for rifles and stuff. And it's like, I'll get into reloading because now I have two old 16s. So I'll get into reloading to make my 16 gauge ammo a little bit more available. So I load up some little 2.5-inch. They're essentially like a 20 gauge load. They're like a little 7/8 ounce, very low pressure, low velocity. I think they pan out to be in like 1,125 feet a second is what I chronographed them at. So real light little loads that I shoot the 16s a fair amount. I enjoy carrying those guns, and it's right at like, the B grade's like just under 6.5 pounds. So it's like not a heavy gun by any means. It's a fun one to carry.
Yeah,
and it's,
that's awesome.
I find myself just like looking at it a lot too. It's kind of fun to have something to look at. It's cool when you're tromping around.
Oh man. Yeah. They're beautiful. I don't admittedly know much about the Fox shotguns. Once you kind of go, you got Sterlingworth and then you go A grade, and then they obviously get rare and rare. I don't really know what, I don't think there's a whole lot that separates when you go to like B, C. I don't know if there's a D, there's an X grade. Like, I think it's mainly just engraving once you kind of go beyond that point. There are higher finish levels and stuff. But yeah, the Fox,
right,
me, they always had that barrel engraving, and that just, you just don't really see that very often. Always love that about them. I still, there's a place in my safe for a Fox A grade or higher. I would be happy with an A grade. I really want to find an A grade with a broken stock, because I want to have Del Whitman or somebody build me a custom stock vintage, like American 16 or 20 gauge. I mean, I'd be perfectly happy with a 16, but I haven't really been looking that hard recently. I've obviously got other guns to keep me busy, but I still would like to find something like that. That's a steal, man.
Yeah, no doubt. And A grades don't seem to be a whole lot different than B grades. B grades are kind of a weird one. From what I understand, there wasn't a whole lot of them, and it was kind of like a weird gap between, like, an A grade was like the gun that a guy would buy if he wanted a nicer gun, but wasn't going to spend a ton of money on one. And then if they didn't buy an A grade, they would buy like a C or a higher. And the B grade was just kind of like this odd gun that there's not a lot of information out there on them. Yeah. You don't see them around a whole lot, but it wasn't like one of those.
Do you have the Fox book that Michael McIntosh wrote?
I don't. I need to get it though. I have like a couple books on the list that I need to grab that are, you know, pertaining to shotgun shooting and American guns and stuff. And I need to pick them up because I'd like to read it and just know a little bit more about it. Like, I know, I guess, a decent amount about like Sterlingworth and a B grade now as I've like researched through it. But I don't know all of it by any means.
Yeah, it's been a while since I read that. But when I was drinking the Fox Kool-Aid, which I still do from time to time. I mean, I love those guns. I bought that book and read it. And we talked about it on the podcast plenty at that time. But there's got to be some stuff in there on the B grade, because that's a pretty much extensive history on those Fox shotguns. So I'm sure there's stuff that you would find in there interesting. So you were able to successfully go back and sort of confirm that serial number was in fact a B grade, because you run into some stuff from time to time where like people upgrade, you know, take a Sterlingworth and make it look like a B grade or something, but it sounds like you tracked it down.
Yep, I did actually before I bought it, and I'd actually messaged Greg Elliott on Instagram. I was like, hey man, can you like help me confirm what I'm looking at here? Like, I think this is a B grade, but it's marked as a Sterlingworth. And he's like, maybe it's a Sterlingworth that someone engraved to look, or, you know, made it look like an A grade or a B grade or something. but just got to, luckily the like Fox Collectors Association has a pretty detailed record of what a gun yep. was by serial number, and it was like very off. If it was a Sterlingworth, the serial number like wouldn't have existed as a Sterlingworth. And it was like clearly a B grade of a certain date range. It worked out. I'm excited about that one. When I first bought it, like, I'm gonna make this thing operable and get this thing rejoined, and I'm gonna sell it. And then I like looked at it for a few weeks and then like shot it. And I was like, I'm not selling this thing. I'm keeping this. I'm never gonna spend the money to buy one of these again. So it's like, I'm gonna go ahead and just keep this one.
Yeah, good for. I mean, it would have been. Yeah, I'm sure you could have flipped it, but I don't think you'll regret hanging on to that one.
No. And there's not a lot.
Is that a 28 inch barrel gun?
It is. Yep. Both. Okay. Oh, I guess all of them now. And I have that LC Smith now that I've been digging with. I don't know if you've seen that project going.
But, yes, I saw that. That beautiful, beautiful looking gun.
Yeah, that was a fun one too. I picked that one up. It's actually sitting right next to me. I picked that up. Just as a project, I kind of like wanted to mess with some, I don't know if you call it gunsmithing or like some little bit of like, not restoration. I feel like that's also the wrong term, but it was kind of like freshening up an old gun, I guess. And picked it up on Gunbroker and made a project out of it. And that one's been fun too. And that's a 28 inch 20
what
gauge.
Did you, I remember seeing like, I actually forgot about that until you mentioned it now, but yeah, you were working on that. Like, what did you do to it?
So it was, the forend was broken pretty bad when I got it. So you could assemble it with the forend iron.
That's right. Okay.
But like a big like wedge of wood was broken off the bottom of the forend from where like the forend iron screws attach the iron to the wood. And it just broke like a big triangle of wood off the bottom of the forend. So like you could assemble it with just the iron, but, it was just really badly oil soaked and a bunch of cracks, in like the wrist and all around the locks, like the side locks and stuff, like normal LC Smith stuff, I guess, now that I got to research in a little bit.
Sure.
And then when I disassembled it, like every one of the four, like, I don't know what you call them exactly, the four pieces of wood that go out around the locks and like the top and bottom tang and stuff, internally, all four of them were broken, or I guess three of the four were broken. So, yeah, just a bunch of like
wood almost like the skeleton of wood around the locks and up near the head of the stock.
And it's very thin. Yeah. It's all very thin wood. And it's pretty normal for them to break. But three of the four were broken. So a lot of it was just woodwork, gluing that back up and then glass bedded the action and all of the where the action meets the wood to just try and get like a better fit to it so it doesn't have any pressure points and build any more cracks over time. And then just like some weird stuff with screws being stripped out and replacing screws and stuff like that. And then just getting rid of all the oil to fix it all was kind of a bigger, I guess like one of the main things that it was like the head of the stock was like black with oil. So acetone soaked it and stuff, got all the oil out of it and then did all the work to fix it and then just refinish a little bit, put a butt pad on it, like one of those, I think the Connecticut orange shotgun. Yeah. It's a Silver's like repo from Connecticut shotgun manufacturing company. Yeah. So it's cool. And I carried it around on Sunday, actually my first day with it, and shot a hunt. So it works and, fires and everything and all was safe and, shot a bird with it. So I'm excited about it.
Yeah. I wanted to look at saw the picture you put up. Yeah. Okay. Yep. You got the big Silver's pad on there and beautiful photo with some prairie grass in the back and a late season hun hanging on the fence post, buddy. Love it.
Yeah, definitely.
Where'd you learn how to do all that handy stuff?
I mean, my dad's a tradesman, so he was always fixing stuff and dinking around with things, but, took a lot of wood shop in high school and a lot of metal shop in high school as much as I could. And, my brother owns like a mechanic shop, so grew up working on Jeeps and building Jeeps and things, old CJ5s and stuff like that. So just kind of grew up messing with stuff.
Yeah, that's really neat. Well, breathing life into an American classic. That's neat.
Yeah, people are bugging me to do another one, I guess. People seem to really enjoy the project on I didn't think people were going to care all that much. I didn't know how many people liked old guns in general that know me on social media. And people have been bugging me to buy another one, but the old gun funds are low after buying this one. And I had to buy a bunch of tools to do all the work too. So I spent almost as much on tools as I did on the gun.
Well, now you're invested though.
Yeah, now the next one will be cheaper.
Yep. See, economies of scale.
Yep.
Love it.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt, Final Rise, and Upland Gun Company. Don't forget to rate, review, subscribe, and share. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can sign up at patreon.com/birdshot. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.